I'm going to talk today, it's the 20th of January 2024, with Chris Caskey, and the subject is Theory and Practice of Judaism. We're going to discuss both. Now, if you haven't heard of me, I'm Ray West, and my website is big-lies.org. It's quite well known. It includes text, HTML text, and I've also got videos and audios on there. And here's Chris Caskey.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you, Ray. So you can buy my book, The War Against Guam, at bigcartel.com. I also have interviews and presentations and stuff on Odyssey, the video website, and Ray West is hosting book reviews of mine too. So that's what I've been up to lately. And by the way, you mentioned your website's HTML, and I quite like the design of your website, actually. I've talked to some people who, they're not fans of it, but I quite like how it's laid out.
Okay, well, Well, thank you. It's nice you'd say so. I do my best. I mean, it's a difficult thing, website design. I don't like WordPress, for example, because you only get the middle third of it coming out, quite from the fact that they can close it down.
And even with you can get these newer monitors which are 21:9 and they're even wider, but HTML is compatible with that.
Yeah.
So that the WordPress is even worse with those monitors. So it's good, even though it's an older format. It's
okay.
Great,
well, it's not likely to be discontinued either because of its age. I think it'll stay when things like WordPress have decayed. Anyway, let me begin with the theory here. Yep. Now, there are two aspects of theory. There's the sort of modern-day stuff, which is spoken about by Jews and so on. But I'll go back here to a book by Christopher Bjerknes, which is reviewed on my site. It's called Beware the World to Come, although the title doesn't really indicate what the contents are about. And my edition of this is 2020, and he's improved it since then. And it's a rather nice 7x10-inch paperback format with a matte cover. Now, I'll just explain the contents. There are four parts. There's the androgyny agenda. Part two is called Satan's Son, which is more than half the book, very long chapter, which is now subdivided. There's three, War of the Sons of Light versus the Sons of Darkness. And four, the ominous Age of Aquarius. And if that sounds like a load of rubbish, then you're on track there. But if you want to, I do recommend the book if you want to understand. If you don't want to wade into all this crap, I don't blame you. But if you want to get a feel for things like androgyny and its part in Jewish sort of folklore, and things like Satan, things like Cain and Abel and so on, and the Jacob and Esau, you ought to read up on this kind of stuff. Now, let me just issue three warnings. Is too strong a word, but they are sort of warnings. One of them is the two obsessed by Catholicism men. There's Michael Hoffman and E. Michael Jones, and in my view, their Catholicism defeats them, really. It doesn't enable them to criticize Jews properly. So although the stuff flickers into there, it's not full-blooded enough. And the other one is Kevin MacDonald of the Occidental Observer, who became famous before the year 2000 with his three books, and since then he's had another disappointing one. But he's an evolutionist, really, and he doesn't seem to realize that evolution is a long-term, enormously long-term thing, and he doesn't really have a phrase for short-term modifications of behavior in the face of opposition, which is what he means, and it doesn't. So there's a kind of problem at the whole heart of there. He, as an example, he put a piece up recently, or allowed somebody else to put up a piece on the Statue of Liberty, and tucked away in that there's a piece on the Kahal, which is a Jewish kind of plot against everybody who's not Jewish, and he should have known about that years ago. So that is really quite sad and disappointing.
Yeah, I think, in my view, he's a bit of a one-trick pony. Like many academics, you know, he kind of pigeonholes himself into just a couple of subjects. and doesn't branch out and hasn't branched out for in decades.
I think
it's a shame. But,
it's a shame, yeah. But that's the way it is. There's nothing we can do about it. We're going to lead into Christianity as a Jewish psyop, as they call it. Christopher's studied the Old Testament and so on, and the New Testament, so he'll do his lead into that.
Great. Okay. So the view that I've come to, which is in the updated edition of my book, is that Christianity was a Jewish conspiracy to take over the Roman Empire, and what turned me onto this was a book called The Jesus Hoax by David Scrivener, which he recently updated, which is very good, but only deals with the Jesus hoax. Like, it's quite a specific book, but it's good. Long story short, Jews were dissatisfied with Roman rule, and I think Rome had overreached the territory a bit, and others were dissatisfied, so they riled people up to expand their support, because Jews aren't so numerous. So, and also there's notions in Judaism that they're entitled to take over other countries and take their wealth and so on, so that was also a motivating factor. For example, the New Testament was authored by Philo Judaeus and Co. in Egypt at the Alexandrian School, and they already had a tradition of rebranding other religions before Christianity, like Hermeticism and Gnosticism, so they were just turning out more rubbish, basically. Christianity was just another fake religion. And then it developed as an insurrectionist movement, basically led by thugs, sort of guerrilla-type fighters who would agitate and destroy temples and burn down forests and burn books and so on. There's a book called The Darkening Age by Catherine Nixie, which it's pretty good. In my view, she's not vociferous enough. I think she could have attacked the Christians even harder, considering what they did. I mean, they destroyed like more than 90% of Latin literature and stuff. A lot of, a lot of the classical world was destroyed, and that's another Jewish policy in their religion, destroying so-called idols.
Yes, that's right. Can I just let me make a point here about the psychology here? They seem to think that they are God. They often refer to themselves as gods, discuss having debates with gods, which their rabbis often win. You see, they've got this rather ridiculous, inflated idea of themselves. Distinguishing themselves evolutionarily from anybody else, and so you get this cumulative set of fantasies, which bite into people and get propagated to the next generation and so on until you end up with, well, people like Prince Charles, who's got no essential idea of how he got where he is, but he's kind of hangs on to it as a sort of puppet or toy. The sort of sequence I'm thinking of is that they start off by having only one God rather than many, and the God has to be a Jewish one. And it has to be in the human image. It has to be a sort of man, because you can't have something that ethereal. It's got to be male. Yeah, it has to be able to talk directly to people. Has to be able to listen to prayers. I mean, I think really this is part of a sort of psychological defect. You know, if you think you're hearing voices, that's usually regarded as a symptom of insanity. But with Jews, it's a part of the package. And anyway, there's a whole list of things like that. Some of it debated by church meetings and so on, or apparently church meetings. And so we've got to the present day where, for example, in the USA, you have vast numbers of people who they're kind of marooned there. They think atheism is a terrible thing, and yet it's an obvious starting point. There's obviously no evidence for a God, so let me just make another point here about practical things. I like to mention Miles Mathis. This is Miles W. Mathis. He's online. He's got his own website, which has been there more than 10 years. He's very good on families, secrecy, and prolonged frauds that Jews operate. and his basis, his the way he works is by searching genealogical sites online, which he's very good. I don't know anybody else who's as good at it. If you want to sample his work, I do recommend that you read it, but also I'd recommend something like DT, so a desktop searcher. The one I use is DT Search, and although it's not incredibly easy to use, it'll give you, if you put in a keyword like Rothschild or something, you'll get a list of his, or Karl Marx, something like that, you'll get a list of his his papers on that. Right, so that's
Mathis is great. He's convinced me there's a lot more Jews than officially claimed. He's outed a lot of celebrities and stuff as Jews. So
he is very good. He does have Jewish input from a bloke called Getzkov, I think, in who, for example, supplied him with material on China and also on the that affair in Europe in about 1900. The Dreyfus affair. It was very famous at the time.
Yeah.
So anyway, so we've mentioned him. Now, now let's get on to more on Christianity. Sorry, I interrupted you there, rather.
No, it's fine. So following the decline of Rome, the sort of dominant power block in Europe became the Franks, and the dominant tribe, the Salian Franks, it's S-A-L-I-A-N, and then the founding ruling family, the Merovingians, who were the ancestors of all subsequent European royalty, believe it or not. So all royals today in Europe, more or less, descend from Merovingians. So there are several sources that indicate that they originated in Greece, actually, and that they set up base in Septimania in France, which was a very Jewish area, and there were a lot of intermarriages. And there's evidence of the Miles Mathis sort that they were crypto-Jews, judging by surnames. And their legal code, which was a very important document, was derived from the Talmud, partially. So they had access to Jewish texts. And another thing I look at in my book is like heraldry. Like a lot of the symbols of these royals are Jewish, like the Lion of Judah, the lily.
Is that the fleur-de-lis?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And the castle representing the Tower of Babel and so on. And basically, I think that was in accordance with Christianity taking over European society. The Franks were gung-ho imposers of it. And by the year 1000, they had taken over what was formerly the Western Roman Empire, called it the Regnum Francorum. And I think the Franks ushered in two important systems, namely feudalism and castles. And they complemented, I mean, feudalism and Christianity complemented each other, I think, because feudalism was sort of designed to privilege Jews, I think, because the Jews ranked highly with the knights. And there's sources in my essay about this, like, for example, Jacob Katz is a Jewish, talks about this. And they were able to bear arms, and they were able to be mobile, and able to, because a lot of the so-called serfs had to remain on their estates. The Jews were allowed to move around. And castles, so the oldest castles that people have found go back to about 900 in France. And the castle was, it had a twofold function. It was a fortress and a residence. So prior to castles, there were communal structures like called Volksburgen, for example, and they shielded entire communities from invasions and animals and so on. But with the advent of castles under the Franks, they you had to be of a high status to be allowed in the castle, so they were just designed for protecting rich people, Jews, and crypto-Jews and so on.
Do you think this was the origin of of Freemasons, or is that being a bit far-fetched? I mean, the people who built these castles must have been, well, it must have been skilled. I mean, it was hard, you know, skilled, difficult work. You had to design the thing, cut out the stone, you know, put it all together. And they must have
That's an interesting
point. I guess they're probably locally not popular. They're like people building a base in some country, building a base for foreigners. So there must have been a certain amount of secrecy and skill and all that sort of thing going together.
As far as I know, the Freemasons were originally, you know, the builders and masons and painters and so on, and then they were infiltrated over time.
Yeah, it does seem like, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In fact, infiltrated by people who didn't do the work. A typical Jewish thing is not to do the work, but to be an administrator or pretend to be an administrator.
So anyway, that's a hypothesis I have, which is a start on that, which I haven't seen anybody else cover, but it's an interesting part of the Middle Ages. And then we have some policies. So something I borrowed from you is that you've documented how Jews and Catholics, they collaborated. Contrary to popular belief, they weren't enemies.
Yeah, I think that's right. Can I just make a few points here? Yes. I mean, it looks as though most or all popes were actually Jews, believe it or not. Gibbon said that of all the early popes. He described them as circumcised Jews. I'm not quite sure what point he was making there. And there's a piece I just put up by somebody in Bosnia. It's on my site. And that chap went through there's a thing called the Avotanyu, I think it is, list of Jewish surnames. And he went through and compared all the recent popes going back, hundreds of years. And he thought that all of them had Jewish surnames, so it looks as though most popes were Jews, contrary to popular opinion.
Like I said, if they the scene from the Merovingians too, then they were crypto Jews more or less from the start. Well, European royalty was, because a lot of the popes were also royalty, like the Medicis, the Borgias and stuff.
Now, it's a bit unfair not to mention that Jews got this. They didn't do it all on their own. They basically bribed other people. And there's an example which I reviewed. There's a book called The Fairchild Family. It's an early Victorian book in English by I think it's an American woman called Sherwood. And it's an enthusiastic thing about how boys should do their Latin and so on, so they could become vicars. And it's very important to realise that vicars, you know, they got paid, they got a regular salary, they got a house, basically. It wasn't, they didn't own it, but they occupied it, they lodged in their house for life, and all they had to do was do Sunday sermons. You know, it's astonishing, really. Yeah. And of course they were in favour of it, generally speaking, because for obvious reasons. I mean, they got money and status, and not much work. And they were in England. Yeah. Sorry, they were in England. There were 30,000 of them. That's the figure I remember. Sorry, what were you about
to
say?
A lot. Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think the vicars and so on, they had cushy work, and they were on board with Christianity, not because of the mythology, but because of the fact they were venal, and it, you know, kept them fat and happy.
That's recently, because of technological changes, that's been challenged. Of course, I mean, the BBC is just as much of a Jewish puppet as the church was, but of course they're broadcasting. You don't have to have 30,000 separate people doing their weekly stuff typically on in three parts. They praise the church and got people to sort of join it up and believe it, and they had official announcements on who they should sort of go out and kill, that kind of thing, or why they should succumb to them. And the third part usually is pleas for money for the church. That's what a typical sermon was. There are lots of them in the 18th century. the English literature was absolutely packed with these things. So, it's anyway. That's the system. The Jews managed to infiltrate by this kind of bribery system. It's exactly similar to modern political parties and trade unions, for that matter.
I have a question. Do you think that the because of course churches were exempt from taxes, and they had the do you think that the tithe system was a rip-off? Do you think taking 10% of people's income was? Do you think it was unfair?
The problem always with Jews is that if you get them involved, they tend to grab everything for themselves, even if it's a desirable system. Right? But so if you look at anything, like politics or the money system, or in this case the church, there were some things they did which I presume were useful, like recording births, marriages and deaths, for example, that sort of thing. I think you can count that as being reasonable. They did sometimes offer advice, probably, well, some of it might have been good advice, I don't know. But of course, insofar as they represent Jews, it's a bad system. So you have to kind of separate out, tease out these elements, just as with, say, paper money. I mean, there's a lot to be said for it, because you know, it's portable and it's easy and handy stuff to have around. But if Jews monopolize it, then it becomes undesirable because they just pay it to other Jews. And with political parties, you get the same sort of thing. If you've got a political party, typically they're run indirectly by Jews and by Jewish money. So the nominal aims of the party, generally speaking, get lost. They're just all erased or kind of suppressed. Or not mentioned. Same with trade unions, you know, like teachers' unions. In principle, it's a good idea to have teachers who are, you know, somewhat unionized and so on. But once you get Jews involved, they insist on people who are not qualified getting jobs, and they control the syllabus and so on. So,
teachers have curriculums that they cannot deviate from.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Exactly.
Yeah.
So, anyway, right. Do you want to get back to Christianity?
I want to mention, because you brought up money, and this, so the usury scheme. So, under Christendom, which was basically Catholic in the Middle Ages, if somebody wanted to borrow money, the church wouldn't lend money. They were the church forced people to borrow from Jews.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah, so the church, they, I think, rather foolishly condemned charging interest as a sin, but in pre-Christian times that was accepted, and I think it's sensible anyhow. But basically, long story short, the Jews became rich through this scheme.
Well,
they were in charge of lending a lot of, you know, the big amounts of money for projects like farms and ships and castles and so on.
The church did in fact borrow money from Jews. They just didn't want anybody else to. I think that's how it worked. Yeah, it's so sad, really. It's a conspiracy against ordinary people, just as same with kings, actually. I think most monarchs were in hoc to Jews, and so you've got this system which exists now in Britain, probably, you know, other places, where the nominal king, the nominal monarch, is in hoc to Jews. I mean, the Queen was perfect in that role. I don't think she ever thought an independent thought in her life, really. Put it rather crudely.
Yeah. So if these vicars and such were motivated by money, in terms of normal people, like nowadays, or people who don't have aren't getting any material benefits from Christianity, what's their psychology? Why do they believe in it?
I think it's declining. I mean,
I see that as well, but there's a lot of people who are, you know, they're not complete idiots, but they still believe this stuff quite passionately.
Yeah, I think people just, I think this is where this Jewish sort of ratchet system comes in. You have one thing after another, and you have all these things built up, and that becomes an established part of the people's way of life. As for example, I mean, in the US, you get. Yeah. I remember there's a chap called Rocker Botus who writes for Kevin McDonald's site, and you can see him saying, you know, he's got all this stuff about Jews, got the, you know, bad thing, rather disastrous, but he draws back from saying that Christianity is the whole thing is fraudulent. He's kind of scared of it,
yeah.
Despite the fact that it's, you know, so in effect he ends up supporting Jews, just a few notches back in the hierarchy of their impositions. But yeah. That's not an expression of why. The explanation is in personal psychology, that people tend to believe stuff that they're taught when they're very little, and a lot of them never sort of snap out of it. Although, in my view, they could do. Right. I remember seeing a comment by Bertrand Russell that on unconscious thoughts, he thought that you can deliberately make an effort of thought to implant it in your unconscious, because after all unconscious thoughts were once dramatic events that you were conscious of. So if there's something that's in your unconscious, presumably you could counter it to some extent just by deliberate effort, but maybe that's too much for most people. Or maybe they're just, you know, there's so many things going on, maybe they just can't risk it. You know, they might lose their job or something, so they pretend to do it. But I think it is definitely fading. I mean, the Church of England now only has 1 million members, and I don't know what you have to do to count as a member, but presumably they sort of pay or something. But 1 million is enormously down from what it was in Victorian times, and it's it'll fade out probably. And I've got it's very sad because they've got these, you know, wonderful buildings, which are in fact, and this may be a deliberate policy, I don't know, the buildings are very nice, very wonderful, but not very practical. You know, take an awful lot to maintain. Same with 18th century housing. You know, you have these country houses, and you know, bloody great things, complete with their own, you know, horse travelling stuff and kitchen gardens and amazing. I mean, really wonderful things, but not very practical. And that may be a deliberate thing, like equivalent to getting a mortgage you can't afford. So anyway, I don't know if that can, how far that goes, but it's not up to, in a way, it's not up to us. I mean, we've got a decision. I'm perfectly happy to debate this with anyone, but I think there are a lot of people who are just, well, they're taking a chance, they're hedging their bets, you know, they think, well, perhaps I'll go to hell. So, and of course the horrors of hell are invented and made up and emphasised as much as possible. So, you know, there it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, do you want to cover? I mean,
let me go into some aspects of the practice, which is the Kahal system, which most people won't have heard about for very good reasons. It's, you know, censored, has been for widely. It leaked out a bit in Poland and Germany in the near towards the end of the 19th century. I think that was because of converts, people, Jews who were in Germany and Poland. Some of them found it, you know, the whole thing disgusting. They didn't want to be part of it. Anyway, the Kahal system is basically you've got a sort of fortress or something, a stockade, whatever you needed, a fortified house, and in that you've got rabbis who were these bearded, freakish things. That, by the way, there are two types. I mean, you've got the Ashkenazi and the Sephardim, at least theoretically. I don't know how far that really extends, and they probably dislike each other to some extent, you know. But anyway, the idea is that you get people who become rabbis, supposedly through a lot of study, probably through mutual things. You know, you'd get some rabbi with probably his sons or something, or favourites, and they'd talk in a way which has been kept secret. I mean, I don't think anything's been published on Jewish educational systems. But anyway, you end up with a lot of rabbis, and they all have, oh, you know, they're arranged in a sort of hierarchy. And there's a hierarchy which is tribally arranged. The Kohens, for example, and the Levites are high up in it. So that in practice, if there's a dispute, I take it anyway. If there's a dispute, if there's a Rothschild, he'll just say, right, this is my decision. And they all sort of fall into line, which makes some sense. It certainly gives them solidity, and it might, with a bit of luck, it'll be part of their undoing as the decisions become more and more silly. Anyway, what they did was they'd have arrangements with the other people, the other Jews, and they'd say, right, you can have these other Jews. They were told they had the right to take over any building that they could, really. So the Kahal would issue them with a sort of monopoly over, suppose, I don't know what your house is, whatever you've got a house, and in secret you would get somebody, you know, Moshi, somebody would be given the entitlement to try to deal with it, rent it, sabotage it, anything was allowed as long as it worked for Jews. And so as a result of all that system, of course, you had secrecy. It had to be kept secret, with probably the death penalty, that sort of thing, you know. And part of it also is deception. The Kol Nidri annual prayer is quite well known as being a solemn occasion where they all swear that the oaths that they've given they don't count. And I think duplicity is part of this. I wouldn't be surprised if the word duplicity itself comes from this aspect of them, that you have double dealing, backing both sides in wars, provided you could get payment from both of them. And division, dividing to try and rule is part of this duplicity as well. And as an example, there's feminism. In the American style, the American Jewish version of feminism, I did a review just a few days ago of somebody called Dale Spencer, who's an Australian. I don't know if she's Jewish. I wouldn't be surprised. Probably is, but I went into that in quite some detail, and that includes the use of the suffragettes to generate the First World War. They were part of the Jewish push to get war between Germany and Russia and the so-called allies, the Anglo-speaking world, which was very successful from their point of view. Tens of millions of deaths, which they didn't worry about. So anyway, the Kahal, that's really part of the Kahal system, all this kind of thing. And that's not so much theoretical, that's a practical thing, which uses their Talmudic stuff to as support, you know, as a sort of handbook. That's I think that's fair enough, isn't it?
I'd like to know more about the Kahal. There's not a lot of sources about it. I think the principal source is Brefman's book, but
I don't think there are more. See, this is something that these people should do, like MacDonald, but I don't think he ever will. There's just no chance, really.
Yeah. Do you want to discuss the USSR now?
Go ahead.
An example of Jewish mass killing. So one of the themes in my book is I concentrate on mass killings and wars orchestrated by Jews, and I think that's one of their aims. They want to kill off Goyim in accordance with their so-called ethics, which goes all the way back to the Old Testament, you know, the genocide of the Canaanites, which are in fact, and they have several commandments in their religion to kill non-Jews. Their holidays are celebrations of mass murders, like Hanukkah of Maccabee Greeks, and Purim of Persians. And yeah, like Ray was saying, they have this duplicitous attitude. And they basically regard, and again, like in Bjerknes's book, he addresses how they view so-called goyim, which is a disparaging word for non-Jews, but basically, you know, regard them as like not human, soulless, and like animals, sort of thing. And over time, I think that their culture had an impact on their genetics. Like what you were discussing earlier with short-term evolution, I think that's a very interesting, I think, because they had this, basically any Jews who disagreed with their religion were cast out or, and basically over time they sort of consolidated their gene pool. I think that's what happened. But anyway, yeah. So I think they have attitudes... They developed attitudes which were a bit more, for want of a better word, psychopathic. Is that, am I off base here, or it's kind of hard to explain? But
it is hard to. The trouble with psychopathy is that they wouldn't accept that, of course, because they regard it as being normal and the sort of thing that people do. But it would be regarded as psychopathy by other people. I think, in fact, the word psychopathy, if you look at the origin of it, it started at the beginning of the 20th century, when psychologists first came in contact with Jews who were, you know, imported into their country by other Jews. And they met them there, these people who had what appeared to them no moral background at all. You know, they'd prostitute their children, they'd steal stuff if they could get away with it. So that's how it started. But, of course, they were too polite or downtrodden or something not to mention that it was Jewish. So, I think that's right.
Yeah. All right, so I'll briefly address the history of the USSR. I'll go through the Russian Civil War, the famines, and the gulags.
Okay.
And this is all quite factual, like standard revisionist stuff, but I think more people could do with knowing about this. Because it's been the Jewish hand in all this has been censored. So the so-called Russian Revolution in 1917 was really a Jewish takeover. It wasn't Russian, it wasn't a revolution, it didn't come from the bottom up, didn't come from disaffected people. It was basically funded from the US, from the USA, and that was instrumental. Good book on that is Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution by Anthony Sutton.
Yeah.
And Jews controlling banks like J.P. Morgan, Kuhn Loeb, and the likes of the Warburgs and the Rothschilds gave the so-called revolutionaries a lot of money, and they it was instrumental.
Yeah, they were also funded by German Jews, weren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Okay. And Trotsky and a contingent of Jews came over from New York, and Lenin and a bunch of Jews came over from Switzerland, and they allowed all the old exiles back in. There was a journalist in Moscow at the time, Robert Wilson, and he found that of 384 commissars in the initial government, 332 were Jews. And in addition to that, the media, so for example, Pravda, which was the mendacious newspaper, which Pravda means truth, so it's obviously it's just facade. And then they had film industry with propaganda, the universities and the unions were taken over by Jews. So it was a very Jewish apparatus. So an important organization they set up was the Cheka, and they targeted dissidents, intellectuals, and in fact working class people, not rich people. Like, and so the whole notion of it being the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics was nonsense, because it was just a name only. And also the Red Army, so-called, was set up with forced military service, so that was run by Jews, but there were no Jews served in it, though, pretty much. And it was called the Voluntary Red Army, but what they really did is they went into the countryside and they recruited peasants against their will to build it up. And the desertion rate was quite high. It was an average of 20%, according to Robert Conquest. So a lot of people weren't on board with it. And then there was, of course, met with resistance. So the Russian Civil War, 1917 to 1923. I found a website called Necrometrics, which aggregates the death tolls of conflicts. And the consensus, a lot of historians put the figure at 9 million dead for that civil war, mostly civilians, about 5 million from famine. So that's a huge conflict.
I'm guessing, but that would be all the weapons would have been funded by Jews, sort of, who are controlled, with control groups who preferably, vicious ones. And That sounds exactly right. Of course, it was not reported in the West at all, was it? I mean, they had not much. Right. The unions would all be, the newspapers were basically Jewish controlled. It's disgusting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I'll just say the churches too went along with it. They knew what, who buttered their bread, and they weren't going to say anything. There's some really kind of quite disgusting messages about how they weren't going to say anything about mass rapes by whoever it was, the Red Army or something, because they're our allies, so you've got to be careful with it. Anyway,
for example, the Cheka who enforced a lot of this oppression and killing. According to Larse, L-A-R-E-C-H, in The Bloodlust of Bolshevism, 50% of the Cheka consisted of Jews with Jewish names, 25% were Jews who had taken Russian names, and all the chiefs were Jews.
Hmm.
There's another book by Richard Pipes, Jewish, The Russian Revolution, 1991. Obviously, the title's bogus. He quotes a member of the early Cheka to the effect that 3/4 of its personnel were Jewish. And the same official stated in the early days amounted to a continuous spree of rape and robbery, though they were, quote, careful to spear fellow Jews, unquote.
Mm. Yeah, we ought to say something here about the survival rate of human beings generally. I mean, Malthus caused a stir when he wrote, this was round about the time of the French Revolution, actually, end of the 18th century. Malthus wrote about populations being dependent on food and that populations would rise according to the food supply and then sort of die off when they starved. And I saw an interesting comment in a book by Hobsbawm, who was a so-called historian in England, Jewish historian. And I noticed an end note or footnote there that said that Malthus was a kind of trivial person, not worth considering. And it struck me, it was an interesting thing to say, because obviously it's, in a normal sense, it's obviously true. If there's people starving, if there are too many of them, they're going to starve. But Hobsbawm didn't say was, of course, if you're a Jew and you can control people, it doesn't matter about the population, they just sort of kill off ones if it's necessary, sort of thing. So we have to be careful about discussing these atrocities, because they might have happened anyway. It's just something different would have happened, but there is Malthus in a way rules, and so that's worth bearing that in mind. Rather than just getting worked up about atrocities, not that I'm fond of them. Anyway, I just thought I'd insert that point.
Right, that's an interesting question. My position is they I think something might have happened, but it wouldn't have been to the same extent of death and suffering.
Yeah, I think people would have taken,
because obviously
steps.
These were intended, obviously, you know, and they took a lot of, I mean, they were, yeah, they had these sort of state-endorsed systems of killing people, you know.
Yeah, the kulaks were one of them, weren't they? They had slogans against them, the supposed the peasants who didn't want to go into collective farms to be bossed around.
So let's discuss that now. So the there were three main famines in the USSR. The one in the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s. And so there were two policies that were important in establishing these. So one is collectivization, where they abolished private property and concentrated the peasantry in state-run collective farms. And the farmers had their houses and property confiscated, and they were removed from their families in cattle trains often. And often a lot of those ended up in forced labor, slave labor camps. And this other thing was de-kulakization, which was the pretense of targeting rich farmers, so-called kulaks, but yeah, they didn't do that at all. So these were, as a case study, the Holodomor in the 30s in Ukraine and southern Russia, and I did a review, which is on your site, of Robert Conquest's book, The Harvest of Sorrow, 1986.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to quote Conquest here. This is a little bit laborious, but it's important. We may sum up the matter as follows. The cause of the famine was the setting of highly excessive grain requisition targets by Stalin and his associates. Ukrainian party leaders made it clear at the start to Stalin and his associates that these targets were highly excessive. The targets were nevertheless enforced until starvation began. Ukrainian leaders pointed this out to Stalin and his associates, and the truth was also made known to him and them and by others. The requisitions nevertheless continued. Such are the major points. We may add subsidiary evidence. Bread rations, even though low ones, were established in the cities, but no such minimum allowance was made in the villages. And the excessive grain targets were not imposed on the most productive grain-producing areas, such as the Russian Central Agricultural Zone. However, even poor Ukrainian regions were targeted. Grain was available in store in the famine area, but was not released to the peasants in their extremity. Orders were given and enforced as far as possible to prevent peasants entering the towns and to expel them when they did. Orders were given and enforced to prevent food legally obtained being brought over the Republican borders from Russia to Ukraine. The fact of famine is fully established by witnesses, high communist officials, local activists, foreign observers, and peasants themselves. Nevertheless, it was made illegal within the USSR to suggest there was a famine. The only conceivable defense is that Stalin and his associates did not know about the famine. This appears impossible to maintain in the face of the above.
Yeah.
So it was an artificial famine. So I think that that wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah. So the NKVD, Law Enforcement Agency, who enforced it, were obviously they're dominated by Jews. There's a lot of evidence for that. Like in my book, for example, there's like lists of names, and Jewish orchestrators included some of the top people. Stalin, Miles Mathis outed him as Jewish. Lazar Kaganovich, Stalin's brother-in-law and deputy premier. Yakov Lev is People's Commissar for Agriculture. Grigory Kaminsky is head of the Kolkhoz, the farm agency for the Russian Republic, overseeing the collective farms. And Philip Goloshokin is party secretary of Kazakhstan. And they also experienced a famine. I think the Conquest reckons that the motive was a campaign against nationalism in Ukraine and to control the farmers. But where I'm coming from is I think that there was this Jewish motive of getting rid of Goyim.
Yeah, Conquest didn't mention Jews, I presume, in any substantial sense.
No.
Yeah, so
no.
That's probably why his book was allowed to be published, in fact.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, what's your view of Chinese communism? Do you think I've only just been, you know, the last few years been made aware of that, but although it makes obvious sense that China was a poor country, they would have been infiltrated by Jews, and presumably a similar process happened there with famine and all the rest of it.
But yeah, I think that's probably true. USSR funded them and assisted them in their civil war, I think in the 20s, and there are a lot of Western Jews who were over there
in China.
Surrounding Zedong, advising him.
So when you say Russia, the USSR funded them, you mean basically it was Jewish money getting through via?
That's what
I expect. Because
I think Mongolia became communist in the 20s, so-called communist, and then it kind of spread through there.
There was a war with Japan, wasn't there? Japan had a war with Russia as well. They were quite important.
But 1905, I think.
Yeah, according to the Miles Mathis view, which is purveyed by somebody else called Unpopular Opinion, Japan was taken over by Jews in the mid-19th century, more or less. And it's a rather terrible story, but anyway, that's... I think we can agree on all this without knowing too much. Yeah,
it's all quite grim stuff. There's stuff on gulags, and then
Go on.
So another book I reviewed is Kolyma, the Arctic Death Camps by Robert Conquest, published in 1978. Grim book. It's good history though. I mean, he omits Jews, but it's an important case study. Basically, obviously the USSR is infamous for its gulags, which were censored in the West. So that book looks at Kolyma, which is a region in the Arctic in eastern Siberia, and that region they had Russia's largest known deposits of gold, so they wanted to mine it, so they used slave labor. So a lot of the farmers, for example, who were taken away as a result of so-called collectivization, they ended up there, a lot of dissidents, and it was pretty easy to be sent there, really. They were pretty ad-lib with who they sent. It was nominally for criminals, the gulag system, but that was a lie. So basically these people worked to death, and they often died of the cold, you know, hypothermia or frostbite. I mean, it gets, in the winter, it gets down to minus 65 degrees Celsius in that region, and they were given inadequate clothing and food and so on. And I think it was deliberate. Conquest, I agree with Conquest that it was a mass murder, deliberate thing.
Yeah.
And I'll just put this, so some of the, I mean, all the gulags were, the chiefs of the gulags were Jews, like, for example, Naftali Frenkel and Matt Weiberman are credited as inventing the system. So Aaron Saltz and Yakov Rappaport and Lazar Kogan ran gulags, and Rheingold Burzin, head of the Dalstroy, who ran the Kolyma death camps. But there's just endless Jews who are involved with this, you know.
Yes, it's terrible. Rather unpleasant stuff. Let's go to this other issue, which is a big splitting point at the moment. I mean, a lot of people can't accept it, which is the idea of Hitler's controlled opposition being part of, because I mean, Germany had Jews in it for centuries. The idea that they were all just chucked out is not very credible once you look into it. I've got a piece on my site called How the Master Race Won World War II. Master race being me sarcastically referring to Jews, but I mean, I'm quite happy with that myself. Although obviously all the details need to be filled in, and there are some people. I mean, for example, David Irving, who I know personally, or at least I did about 20 years ago or so. He went into great detail, but he never, all the archives he went to were not, you know, just exclusive Jewish ones. So I don't think he's ever had the opportunity to look through stuff in which, if they keep it at all, if they keep records at all, in which Jews are. It would be nice to have a Jewish view of the Second World War. You know, they'd have this, they'd do this, and they do that, and they do the other thing, and it would include inventing fakes and controlling military leaders like Eisenhower, who was a Jew from Sweden, and Churchill. Yeah. How Churchill was, well, there's a story that Churchill needed the money and he was bribed. I don't know if that's true. He would have done it anyway, I think. And Stalin, and there's also lots of Jewish groups in Europe itself. I mean, for example, Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia were both, they had a Slav component, but they also had the Jewish component. For example, Prague was essentially a Jewish town. And so there's plenty of opportunity for...
So,
yeah.
If I could just interject, let me mention Bjerknes again. His book, Adolf Hitler, Bolshevik and Zionist, which is that there's a series of them, biographies about Hitler and the Nazis. And yeah, I concur with him that he makes a good case that Hitler was essentially just like an agent. He worked for communists in there were temporary communist republics in Germany in the 20s. He worked for those. And he was recruited by Ludendorff and Mayer and the German military to infiltrate the German Workers' Party and turn it into the Nazi Party. And there's a document, I Was Hitler's Boss, which is by Karl Mayer, where he talks about how Hitler was sort of an agent. And there were others at the time who were saying this. And... I think there were genuine Nazis. I mean, like maybe Gottfried Feder, who came up with a lot of the economic stuff, and he was kind of sidelined, though. He was relegated to a small job at a university. And also some of the brown shirts were killed in the 30s. And I think there was this... Yeah. Also, a lot of them were top Nazis were Jewish. There's obviously Brian Riggs. He's probably the most famous, his book, Hitler's Jewish Soldiers. But there's other... That piece you put up on the Balkans, Jews in the Balkans, and how he, that writer refers to like surnames and
there's loads on
there. And how the popes were Jewish. But he also apparently like there's like a thing about the Nazis and how they had Jewish surnames, Galatian Jewish surnames from the 15th century, like Hitler and Himmler and so on.
Yes. There's a good piece by Mathis on that, especially on Hitler.
He had like a kosher diet or something as well. But there's a lot of them were Freemasons too, apparently.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Rather depressing to see that this complete control. There was a debate, wasn't there, between Bjerknes and a chap calling himself Dennis Wise, and
yeah.
I think Bjerknes won it, but he wasn't very polite to Dennis Wise. He didn't see where Wise was coming from, which was the conventional view, really. But anyway, so that's this is teething problems of people coming to grips with a new theory, isn't it?
Yeah. Let me mention something here about the funding of the Nazis. So there's an important book is Die Geldbrunnen van het Nationale Socialisme, The Financiers of National Socialism by Sidney Warburg, published in 1933, which apparently today is in the Social Archive of Zurich in Switzerland. But at any rate, in June 1929, bankers and industrialists met secretly in New York, and they decided that a so-called revolution was to happen in Germany, and they decided on the National Socialist regime, because communism had sort of been rejected in Germany.
Yeah, it was.
So according to Sutton, in total, Hitler received at least $32 million from American financiers, Morgan, Lamont, Rockefeller, Kuhn, Loeb & Company, General Electric Company, National Citibank, and others between 1929 and 1933. And I used an inflation calculator, and in 2024, that's about $672 million, or about £527 million.
Mm.
And they could spend that on, you know, propaganda, for example.
Well, it worked, didn't it? 1933 was when they did. Came to fame, came to prominence. Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, but of course it's a difficult issue. I mean, I noticed that there's a woman called Texas Girl, I think, in the Occidental Observer, who is pro-Hitler without being too clear about it. I think these people, I don't know whether these people are some sort of controlled opposition. They could be, because they refuse to recognize the possibility of Hitler being just another one of them. Depressing stuff. Can I just go back? This is something completely different. I've got a little note here on it, that the reason that Jews appear to have started at all, and there could be other people, I've seen them as Illyrians, for example, suggested. It could just be a group which has coagulated together, but anyway, they call themselves Jews. They seem to. The reason they seem to have become famous was because of the Mediterranean Sea. The Mediterranean is quite obviously it's enclosed. It's not an open sea with huge disasters, apart from having the occasional volcanic eruption. And so shipping was pretty much invented there, and Jews financed it and had little local groups which were in touch with each other, and of course able to move out if they wanted to. They could go and go to another section of Jews, and that's very important. I think the Med is the single most important geographical aspect of Jews, in case people are wondering where it came from, where it started.
And I think you wrote that was important in spreading Christianity, that region, because of the trade and
and the locations and the people there. That's right.
Yeah,
and it's also the biggest, by a huge margin, it's the biggest inland sea anywhere in the world. And it makes the Great Lakes in the USA look like a little small change, you know. And it has more. I mean, the Caspian Sea used to be a lot bigger. There's a huge, I don't know the reason for it. There's some kind of declivity or something which enabled it to fill with water. But that was very, very important for the whole history of civilization and anti-civilization, for that matter. Let me make another. Here's another point. I've got a note here. There was a. How serious is it? I just don't know. I just noticed an archaeologist called Israel Filkenstein, Filkenstein, in Tel Aviv University, who's made a special study or report on all these non-existent characters like Moses, Abraham, you know, Isaac, Jacob, Noah, and so on. And so there is a movement in Israel to rationalize, to make sense of all this history, and say that it's nonsense.
Yeah, I cited him. The Bible Unearthed in my book. I think that came out 2001. He points out that the modern borders of Israel were not the historical borders that Jews lived in.
Right.
That it's based on, the modern borders are based on a myth of this unified kingdom. But in fact, if you look at modern Israel, it's built up in the northwest, Tel Aviv area. But in fact, Jews didn't live in that area. So they don't have any rights whatsoever to that part. But arguably, they have some rights to the south.
This is what Filkenstein said, is it?
Yep.
Okay, because I mean, I have a natural tendency to assume they're telling lies, or, you know, diverting attention or something.
I think, I think you have to read between the lines, so to speak.
Yeah. Let me go to another topic here, which I've made notes on. I was just scribbling some notes down earlier. Problems with it, problems with Judaism, how it might be exposed or destroyed or converted or something. This business about androgyny is obviously, I mean, it's ridiculous. You can't possibly have one sex of reproduction. I mean, it's not going to work. DNA is a very serious stabilizing factor if you've got two parents. So that's a weakness and a nonsense. And, you know, of course, sexual reproduction is quite a useful thing, quite a practical system. So that's a problem. Yeah. Another thing is this insistence on having one single, they call it a Mashiach, I think, Moshiach, something like that, a Messiah. Why have one? They work as a group, so why should they expect there to be one Messiah? It just seems ridiculous to me, and of course it leads to fights.
According to Buchness, there's two Messiahs.
Oh.
There's the Messiah son of David, who's the good one, and then Messiah son of Joseph, who's the bad one, and it's so stupid. It's stupid. It's absolute bullshit. But anyway, Buchness reckons that Hitler sort of fulfilled the role of the Messiah son of Joseph, because their role is to deliberately provoke the Jews into punishment if they've been bad, and Hitler served the role of creating a climate in Germany to encourage Jews to leave. So by 1940, about 500,000 Jews had already left to Palestine.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I say okay, I'm not sure about that. There's business about Jews as parasites. I don't know. I wrote a piece on that, which I thought was quite good. Parasites are a relatively new discovery. I mean, they've known about things like liver flukes for many, since the modern era. But human parasitism is a different thing, there's no theory for it, as I know of. And one of the consequences of parasitism is, or maybe, the attraction to any prosperity. You know, this is what Jews tend to move wherever they sucked some area dry, like Rome, then they move on to somewhere else, like the Arab countries. You know, they invented Islam. Or in the USA, they've plundered the USA, and they're going to try to move somewhere else. Maybe China is their motive, because they have a sort of psychological need or desire to plunder. And that's, if that becomes widely known, provided, you know, the Jews have succeeded so far because they spread themselves out more than other people. They're like a nation which is spread out over other countries, like a sort of layer. So anyway, if the other countries get together, this is one of the reasons I like this. I've got a section on my website. The last thing that I put up there was this piece by a Bosnian chap who's a scientist. Actually, he's not. Well, I tried to find out what his actual views are, but he hasn't replied to me. But if people in Bosnia, if there was a unified system of revisionism, you know, you could look up Bosnia and you get a potted history of them and the Jewish influence. The same with Spain, Italy, Britain, New Zealand, for that matter, Australia, the USA, so that you could look this up, and that would certainly break something of a logjam, wouldn't it? Because in that way, it could be spread much more efficiently. And now that, assuming that internet is going to be allowed to survive, that could be very important. That's why I do it myself. That's why I put these things up, even if they're not very convenient. I've got one on India, for example, where there was the East India Company and so on. I mean, the Indians were plundered, so, like the Chinese and the Japanese. So if that becomes widespread, then that would be a good thing in my view, because Jews tend to hide very severely behind censorship.
A good example good example of plundering, or well, a horrific example, in fact, is the colonization of Mexico by the conquistadors, and a lot of those were Jews, like the leaders of the army and that sort of thing. I cover that in my essay on the Inquisitions, because of course they also had an Inquisition, you know, there, they you know, killing off the pagans and
yeah,
getting the resources.
I've
that's sad as well, but
I've got a suggestion. We're it's not obvious to people listening, but we are actually running late. Should we stop here and do another one later?
Yeah.
Well, unless you've got...
Yeah,
unless, okay, let's
yeah,
do that.
Yeah, it's fine by me.
Oh, good, all yeah. right. Well, look, it's really nice to speak
I'm
to
just,
you.
And yeah, you too.
You're about a third my age, so I'm hoping... See, when I was your age... I couldn't speak to anybody about anything like this. Literally, not a single person. So I'm hoping that it can spread, not just spatially, but also temporarily in time.
Yeah.
And New Zealand, well, why not? It's as good a place to start as any.
Yeah.
So, okay, let me just repeat. My website is big-lies.org. And Chris can finish with his repeating his one.
Yeah, you can get my book on bigcartel.com, and if you like, you can check out my book reviews on biglies.org. And got more of those coming, and yeah, we'll do another talk. Sounds good.
That's terrific. Okay. Well, thanks very much for speaking to me.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you.
Well, that's fine. Bye then.
Bye then.